Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our discussion today is about environmental exposures that have been linked to breast cancer. We're fortunate to have a couple of very good experts on this area, and they're joining us both by telephone. Connie Engel is Science and Education Manager for the Breast Cancer Fund, and Janet Ackerman is a staff scientist with the Silent Spring Institute. Also in the studio and listening to us a little bit and occasionally making some comments about a lecture series that will feature Connie and Janet and another person in Anchorage shortly is Patty Saunders. Patty is Development Director for the Alaska Community Action on Toxics. So please listen for her to come in if you want to hear more, particularly locally, from these experts on breast cancer and environmental links. During the program, here's how you can get in touch with us if you have questions or comments. Our Anchorage number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Welcome to all of you. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Great to be talking to you.
We're going to ask our guests all to kind of remember, as well as myself, to let them, our listeners, know who's talking so we can try to make it clear about who's answering which questions and what their comments are. And Janet, let's start with you, if you don't mind telling us a little bit about the Silent Spring Institute and yourself and what you're doing, and then we'll do that with Connie and with Patty.
Absolutely. Thank you. So I've been working at Silent Spring Institute, which is a nonprofit located near Boston, Massachusetts. We focus on studying and understanding possible links between environmental pollution, environmental chemicals, and human health, but especially breast cancer. We were founded in 1994 in response to concerns about high levels of breast cancer on Cape Cod in Massachusetts, and we've been expanding our research program ever since. Like I said, I've been working here about 4 years, and I've worked on a variety of projects. Most recently, we published a review in a journal run by the National Institutes of Health that reviewed about 100 chemicals that we believe may be linked to breast cancer and ways that researchers and others could start testing for them in samples from people.
Okay. Janet, thank you very much. Connie?
Yes. So I'm with the Breast Cancer Fund, and we are based in San Francisco, California. We were founded in 1992. So just right about the same time, actually, that Silent Spring was founded, and there was quite a lot, actually, at that time going on around breast cancer advocacy and breast cancer in the environment. So it was, you know, quite a fruitful time. We consider ourselves to be a science-based advocacy organization, which means that we advocate to reduce breast cancer, to prevent breast cancer, to reduce environmental links to the disease. And we do so based upon the best current science out there. So we do a lot of reviewing the evidence, looking at peer-reviewed literature across a range of research methods in order to guide our public education, market-based campaigns, and policy advocacy.
Okay. Thanks very much. And Patty, you have invited the two of them plus another person in this area to be here in June.
In June, yes. The third woman's name is Karuna Jagar. She's the executive director at Breast Cancer Action in San Francisco, and they are a very strong advocacy organization around breast cancer prevention. Their motto might be, we can't shop our way out of this. We need help from the government to regulate the chemicals that are connected with breast cancer that Connie and Janet have been talking about. Mm-hmm. So we thought these were three of the most powerful groups in the country. And Alaska Community Action on Toxics, which you may have heard of as ACAT, that's mm-hmm. easier to say. We've been working for many years on the connection between exposure to chemicals and pollution in the environment with human health, and particularly cancer, since number one, it's deadly, and number two, there is a lot of science around it. There is a lot of collection of information, and so it's something that you can make the case when the connection is there between those chemicals and cancer. It doesn't mean it's the only thing we're concerned about. There are many, many other health effects that can come from chemicals. A lot of what we're looking at right now is endocrine-disrupting chemicals, which affect people's fertility. They influence the outcomes of pregnancies, the ability to become pregnant. A lot of information is coming out right now about what is called the feminizing of boys, where boys' genitalia is not developing the way it should because it's being exposed to endocrine-disrupting chemicals. So there's a lot of that. There's a lot of military sites in Alaska. Most people are aware of that, but they may be less aware that when the military left those sites, they left behind all their stuff. They just bulldozed it over in barrels, and it's there right below the surface, contaminating the land and the water and the animals and the berries and whatever else people are foraging for out there. So we're trying to help people understand those connections and do something about them whenever possible.
All right. Thanks very much, Patty. Connie and Janet, what I'd like to do is start off with a little bit of just background information about breast cancer, what we know about breast cancer, what we know about the strong associations, what's natural history, what the epidemiology is, and then we can move on and focus to some of the concerns about these endocrine mimickers or effectors and chemicals and so forth. If that sounds all right, that's how I think I'd like to get into this program.
Absolutely.
Sounds great.
So one of you tell me a little bit about the basics of just breast cancer, what we know about cancer, how it relates to breast cancer, and then whoever is not talking can edit that or make additional comments as needed. So whichever one of you would like to start, go ahead.
So I'll pop in and go first. I think one of the very important sort of prefaces to the story of breast cancer starts with defining that term in the first place. So we know as of right now that there are at least four clinically derived subtypes of breast cancer, and those are described on the basis of the hormone receptors that are on the tumors, and you know, those various characteristics. Genetically, they have done some research to demonstrate that those breast cancers do have different gene profiles. The tumors have different genetic sequences, and there may be actually quite a few more than four subtypes if you look genomically. And so when we want to look at environmental links or any other precursor or causal association with breast cancer, we may need to look very carefully at those different subtypes because they may have actually quite different associations and or causes on, you know, any sort of risk exposure and genetic predisposition.
So is it fair to say then, if I'm hearing you right, and this was Janet, right?
That was Connie.
Sorry, Connie. So if I'm hearing you right, it's almost like one of the problems with doing research in this area is that we've got something called breast cancer, but it's really maybe at least four different kinds of breast cancers, almost like four different diseases, which complicates matters.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Janet, I would add that those four types are very important clinically. We also often in the literature end up breaking down breast cancers by the age of the woman when she's diagnosed. Most mostly in terms of is it before or after menopause, and those end up, the literature on that ends up showing that you do end up finding somewhat different causes for premenopausal and postmenopausal, which is much more common types of breast cancer.
All right. And one just little bit of comment for the listeners. The hormone receptors that we're talking about is hormones react within the body at various cells levels, and they attach by almost like a lock and key mechanism. And so what Connie was implying, and Connie, tell me if I'm wrong, is that these breast cancers have different receptors, that is, different hormones may attach differently and trigger different chemical reactions within the cancer, or they may respond to different kinds of slightly different hormones. So again, there's some complexity that is maybe listeners are not entirely clear about. Did I do a pretty bad job of that, Connie, or did that help?
Yeah, so this is Connie. You did a great job, and I think maybe an example helps to clarify. So, you know, one of the very common types is estrogen receptor positive tumors. And so those cells in an estrogen receptor positive tumor, they already receive the hormone estrogen, which, you know, is a fairly familiar word. It's in, you know, birth control pills and hormone therapies. And so in the presence of estrogens, because those cells have that receptor, they grow really fast. They reproduce very quickly. Hmm. So that's, you know, one of the subtypes that we talk about clinically that has that characteristic.
One other thing. Go ahead.
I was just going to say people may have also heard of sometimes what's referred to as triple negative breast cancer, and that's one of the types that's much harder to treat, has a worse prognosis. That is a type of breast cancer where you don't have the estrogen receptor or two other types, the progesterone and HER2 receptors. So whereas with an estrogen receptor positive tumor, if you block estrogen, you're able to block the growth of that tumor to some degree. If the tumor doesn't have those receptors, that means it's basically evolved a way of growing without those hormones, and so you've lost that ability to treat the tumor by denying those hormones.
Okay.
Yes. And one important thing about the triple negative type is that it's also more common in African-American women and Latinas. So these different subtypes not only occur in different age groups at different rates, but in different populations at different rates. And so we're actually seeing a lot of young African-American women diagnosed with triple negative, which is very hard to treat. So we have disparities happening in there that are really important to keep our eye on the ball with.
Yeah, implying different mechanisms of which these things may be developing. Is that what you're saying?
Well, different mechanisms, but also, you know, simply from a health perspective and a public health perspective, when we see disparities like that, we have, you know, a mandate to be aware of that because it is affecting different populations differently.
Yep. And one other thing I think might be fruitful to bring out about cancers, and again, I'm a pediatrician, so don't hesitate to set me right, but my understanding is our understanding of cancer now is that cancers in general are multiple hit problems in that there are multiple genetic abnormalities that are happening in our genome that trigger a series of events over time that finally leads to cancer. There may be one that causes a cancer to be able to metastasize, another one that may say, well, okay, now you can develop your own blood supply. So there's a lot of differences in cancer cells than regular cells, and the theory, as I understand, is that there takes multiple hits to make these changes, and so it's usually that's why one of the reasons why most cancers happen as you get older or age is an important factor. Is that first true, and is it important for us to understand that when we start talking about the causes of breast cancer?
I think that's a pretty good explanation. There's a lot of people kind of arguing within the cancer research world about the relative importance of you know, what sequence and what happens mm-hmm. when. But mm-hmm. I think that's a pretty widely accepted idea that you need a few different, sometimes we call them insults,
right.
A few different hits, like you said.
Right.
It's also worth noting that people are more or less susceptible, especially to damage genetically to the breast, at different ages.
Yeah.
And so this is, we saw after the bombing of Hiroshima, actually, women who had not yet hit puberty or who were in puberty at that time had much higher rates of breast cancer much later in their life. And the thought is that's because they were exposed to that radiation, which damages DNA, at a time when their breasts were particularly susceptible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good point.
And I would add to, this is Connie, I'd add to that that increasingly we're seeing different, in particular, chemical exposures, sometimes dietary exposures, that when a being is exposed prenatally, they are predisposed to a later life vulnerability.
Right.
Because of the way that that may affect the hormone system, or, in fact, induce not changes to that person's genes, but to how those genes are expressed, and that those changes in gene expression actually continue onward throughout that person's life, and some of them can even be passed on through generations.
Yeah, that to me is a very important point and extremely fascinating development from genetics. And what you're saying is that we now know that even in utero exposures can have lifelong increased your risks of certain problems over a generation and even be passed on to subsequent generations. It's hopefully we'll have time to spend more time on that aspect, because that also complicates research, it would seem to me, extremely in an extreme way. What about,
yes, absolutely.
What about epidemiology? I think you both implied, if I remember rightly, that your organizations got going in the 90s, so suggest that somewhere around the 90s, maybe we were seeing more breast cancer than were at least being diagnosed more. What's happening with breast cancer diagnosis over time and the true incidence and so forth?
All right, so around the 1970s, if you were looking in the 1970s and looking at the incidence rates, you would say, okay, if we have this same rate of breast cancer for the foreseeable future, then a baby girl born today has about a 1 in 11 chance of being diagnosed with breast cancer. Today, if you did that same calculation, a baby girl born today would have about a 1 in 8 chance. So that we went from about a 9% lifetime risk to a little over 12% in the course of about 40 years. So that's that definitely suggests, you know, that's a pretty big increase. I don't know if Connie has other statistics that you like to use, but that something going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are statistics that are adjusted for age at diagnosis, which is quite important, of course, epidemiologically, because we do know breast cancer is diagnosed more often at later ages. But when we adjust for that, we still see that incidence increase. They don't believe that that's due to increased screening, because if we talk about invasive breast cancer, that eventually shows up, but we are often finding it now sooner. So mortality has declined for most populations because of that earlier screening, but we're not necessarily seeing the same, that's attributed to the incidence changes, or the incidence changes are attributed to the screening.
Right.
Yeah.
So in my reading, it's the length of time of exposure to estrogen is an important factor. So what you were saying is that these numbers may have appeared to decrease because people are getting older, or women are getting older, and so you have to adjust that for age so that that's not a confounding variable?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay. I also read, which again is another confounding variable, and again, I'm not, what I'm hoping the listeners are getting is that this research can be very difficult to do very well, but women are having babies later. So is that a significant factor in these statistics, possibly?
You know, you've got a whole host of various factors happening related to reproductive history and background, and that includes not just pregnancy, but also age of onset of puberty. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that researchers look at is overall and over lifetime exposure to estrogen, steroid hormone, being linked to breast cancer. That's a pretty compelling link and one that's widely cited, widely agreed upon. So that is about age of onset of puberty, age of onset of menopause, so the number of years between those two, age at first pregnancy, number of pregnancy, breastfeeding, all of those factors do have a determination. And absolutely, pregnancy before age 35 is protective for breast cancer. There is some recent evidence that suggests that women who get pregnant a little bit older in life may actually have a very temporary increase in risk of breast cancer, pregnancy-induced breast cancer. And so all of those fertility-related, reproductive history-related factors are happening at once. Puberty age is actually dropping in the United States quite precipitously. So that's another key factor to look at there.
Right. And I think from my practice, a lot of people are under the assumption that the reason for puberty age being dropped is perhaps related to chemical exposures. But another factor that seems to be related is obesity, which is related to having earlier puberty. But then you can get into the argument with maybe some of our obesity has some relationship to exposures as well. Anybody like to comment on that?
I think you said it, really. Like everything else, it's very hard to tease them apart, but there does appear to be very good evidence that earlier puberty and obesity is at least associated with exposures to especially endocrine-disrupting chemicals. And so the longer, so when you've got both the age of puberty dropping and the age at first childbirth increasing, you've got a longer and longer period where the breast is exposed to at higher levels of estrogen, but hasn't gone through the kind of differentiation steps that have it happen during pregnancy. And so, again, that's a longer window of we sometimes call that the window of susceptibility, where it's a time when the tissue could be vulnerable, especially to environmental chemicals. So it's very much not one or the other. There's a lot of interactions between all different risk factors.
Let me take 1 second just to remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. We're talking about environmental links to breast cancer with Connie Engel of the Breast Cancer Fund and Janet Ackerman of Silent Spring Institute. Also in the studio with me, the other two previously mentioned are on the telephone from their offices, but Patty Saunders is with the Development Director of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, who is bringing Janet and Connie and one other individual up for a series of lectures, which we'll talk about again in before we get off the air. That'll be here in next month. So if you've got questions or comments, our local number 550-8433, our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. So given all the complexity, and I would have to say that in my mind, we have only kind of topped or kind of hit the highlights of the complexities of doing research, particularly in this area. How do we get into and begin to tease out environmental links, and what is it about the epidemiology that makes us concerned about toxic or environmental links?
Well, there's a few ways of looking at that, and I think that one of the things to keep in mind is that it's often because breast cancer takes so long to develop, often you can get good evidence from laboratory studies that's worth acting on. But what we know from epidemiology studies is, like we've been saying, that lifetime exposure to estrogen and a number of related factors definitely have impact. We've seen that pharmaceutical hormones, including hormone replacement therapy and a chemical called TPS that was given to pregnant women I never remember exactly the dates, but in the 50s, I believe, in the 60s, definitely increase risk. And so that leads us to suspect chemicals that act as estrogens, as well as chemicals that, like we've said, damage DNA.
And there are, you know, certainly... Oh, are you finished, Janet?
Oh, I was just going to ask if you had anything to add.
Oh, great. that there are some epidemiological studies, very often from, you know, some serious accidental exposures that tell us something important about environmental links to breast cancer. So Janet mentioned the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and seeing that women who were younger during those explosions, which of course emitted large amounts of radiation, had elevated risk of breast cancer. We also know that girls who are exposed to high levels of medical radiation for things like scoliosis, lymphomas, and other illnesses also have higher rates of breast cancer later in life. So those are some examples that give some very strong evidence that radiation is a key environmental link to breast cancer. Another example is a really quite novel and compelling study, and it is on the pesticide DDT, which Rachel Carson, to whom the Silent Spring Institute owes their name, wrote the book Silent Spring about this pesticide, which was sprayed quite widely after World War II. And for a long time, you know, there were suspicions of a link to breast cancer, and a researcher here in the Bay Area was able to get some banked samples from young women around the time when there was a lot of DDT spraying, and inferring from their age at the time the spraying was the highest, was able to draw some associations from, you know, human epidemiological data, and see that women who were younger during the time of highest DDT exposure had higher rates of breast cancer. So those kinds of sort of natural, rather unfortunate experiments can give us some really strong epidemiological hints about the situation that we're looking at.
Okay. I think one thing that's really interesting about that study that Connie was just describing is also that that you really had to get those older blood samples in order to be able to see that association, because there had been a number of studies that would test women's blood after they were diagnosed with breast cancer, and the pesticide DDT doesn't stick around in a person's blood, but a breakdown product of it does. So, and it turns out that when you test for that breakdown product, you don't end up seeing the association, and you've let many decades go by, so any difference is naturally going to be muted.
Okay.
So it's also a good example of a case in which a negative result in some studies, could be misleading if you don't have the ability to look at exposures in early life.
What I'd like to do now is we are going to take our normal kind of mid break, and then we'll come back. We'll be off the air for just about a minute, Janet and Connie, and then we'll join you again. Let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Toll-free 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. www.kskaanchorage.org. After a short break, we're going to rejoin the discussion on environmental links to breast cancer and our guests Connie Engel, Janet Ackerman, and Patty Saunders. This is Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests are Connie Engel of the Breast Cancer Fund and Janet Ackerman of Silent Spring Institute. They are both joining us by telephone. And in the studio is Patty Saunders. She is Development Director for the Alaska Community Action on Toxics. We're discussing environmental links to breast cancer, and you can email your questions during the next almost 30 minutes to line1@alaskapublic.org. Or you can call us locally, 550-8433, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. You can also listen to the program between 9 and 10 each Monday evening. That's a rebroadcast. We won't be able to answer your questions. Or you can go to our archives at alaskapublic.org, hit the Line 1 link, and you can listen to the program or refer somebody else to listen to the program. And another way is just put in Line 1 at podcast place at Apple, and you'll come up with our program. It gets on there pretty quickly. It's another way to listen to this program or prior ones. Before we get back to Connie and Janet, I'm going to ask Patty once again, would you tell us a little bit about the plans for the lecture series?
Yes, we're really pleased and excited that Connie Engel, Janet Ackerman, and Karuna Jagar of the Breast Cancer Action are going to be here live in person in Anchorage on June 5th. They'll be making a presentation at the LUSAC Library at 6:30, and everyone is welcome to attend. The following day, June the 5th, we're going to split up, and somebody from Alaska Community Action on Toxics will accompany each of these wonderful people to a smaller community. We'll be in Bethel at noon. That's Connie and another one of our staff, Murray Carmen. And in Homer will be Karuna Jagar with our executive director, Pam Miller, and myself. And in Fairbanks, Janet Ackerman with another staff person named Samarise. So those are both in the evening. You can get more information, the details, the places, and the times at our website, www.akaction.org. We would love to see you there. It's free, by the way.
Okay, thanks very much for that. Janet and Connie, let me start the second half of the program by asking, other than radiation, which has been mentioned, what are the more common environmental exposures that have some pretty interesting associations with breast cancer that you all would like to mention?
So I would call out a number. This is Janet. I would say a number of chemicals found in air pollution have some pretty strong links to breast cancer, or especially based on laboratory evidence, based on what we know about other cancers, and based on some, there's somewhat contradictory information in the literature about the effects of smoking on breast cancer, and that appears to have to do with, again, with kind of looking at when people, what age people are when they're diagnosed. But there's a number of chemicals in air pollution, and both from car exhaust and from other sorts of burning materials. There was an industrial accident in Italy, actually, where a large amount of a chemical called dioxin was released into the environment, and a community had much higher levels of a number of cancers, including breast cancer.
Connie?
Well, so I would certainly second what Janet talked about. One of the air pollution chemicals we're quite concerned with is polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which interestingly leave a trail in the body that can be measured. And so you can do some interesting studies in that way. In addition, we look quite a lot at what we've already talked about a little bit, endocrine disrupting compounds. And though the science around this idea of endocrine disruption is a relatively new emerging area of research, so we're seeing a lot of activity there. Of course, being new, it means that the evidence quite varies, the strength of the evidence across the different chemicals that appear to have these endocrine properties. But we're concerned about chemicals that can mimic estrogen, throw off estrogen, that mess with some particular stuff that happens in the body that actually converts testosterone into estrogen. So there are a host of these, and indeed some of the chemicals that disrupt the thyroid hormone, because there are some complex ways that the endocrine system interacts with itself. So these include chemicals that are found in plastics, in personal care products, in everyday household products, indeed sometimes in our food, either through pesticides or food packaging, and definitely in air, water, and even sometimes in healthcare settings. Mm-hmm. So these are, you know, some of these have some human studies that have either been intentionally done, or some of these accidental cases that, you know, we talked about, like with DDT, which is certainly one of those. And some of them have more laboratory data or cell culture data. And there's a whole gamut of strength of data that we could talk about there.
I would add, this is Patty, I would add that if you go to the websites of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, Breast Cancer Fund, Breast Cancer Action, or Silent Spring Institute, you will find a lot more detail than we're able to provide here on the specific chemicals and where they're found in the products that we might be exposed to.
Okay. And I, this may be naivete on my part again, but I'm wondering if there isn't a somewhat of a disconnect between what is actually being removed by regulation from foods and cosmetics and plastics and that which is of suspect. How does the mechanism work? How do researchers convince a regulatory agency of the need to remove products, and how difficult or easy is that?
I would say it's definitely difficult. You know, we have a regulatory system that actually is quite inadequate to the task of dealing with this issue. This is Connie, by the way. Mm-hmm. Basically, the main biggest law governing the use of chemicals in the United States is the Toxic Substances Control Act. It was passed in 1976, and I always invite people to think about where they were in 1976. Some people were very, very young at that time, and you can imagine that the science has changed rather substantially since that point, right? So we have a law that is based on 1976 science when the 2014 reality is quite different. It's gone 37 to 38 years without a single update. At the time it was passed, 62,000 chemicals were grandfathered in with no safety data, no safety review. And only 200 of those grandfathered chemicals have been tested thus far. Only 5 chemicals have been regulated. So the burden of proof to really get regulatory action on many of these chemicals is really quite challenging. And asbestos, for instance, not linked to breast cancer, but linked to lung cancer, was not able to be banned through this law. Hmm. And we're all familiar with the effects of that. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very challenging. Recent legislation has introduced revisions to that law, which really most of the new proposed legislation either maintains the status quo or may actually make the situation a little bit worse.
All right. I have a caller. Before we continue the conversation, I want to do that. And I also have a couple of emails as well I'd like to address. So, Pam, you're on line one.
Thank you, Dr. Woodard, and this is a great program. I really appreciate it. I was interested, and you've addressed some of this, but I was interested to hear more about some of the hazards of household products that could include cleaning products, personal care products, and others that we might be exposed to in our own homes and workplaces, and just a little bit more about why is it that our system of law is not protecting us, because it seems that we can make smart personal choices at the store, but that's not really enough. And I'd like to hear about more opportunities for how we can take collective actions to change policies. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Pam.
Yeah, Janet, you want to fill the first part and I'll take the second?
Sure, absolutely. So there are the first, I'll talk about kind of what's in them. So there are a number of chemicals of concern in household products. When you talk about cleaners, we'd be particularly concerned about solvents and fragrances in both cleaning products and personal care, cosmetics, everything from makeup to shampoo. So solvents are of concern because they're just kind of by their nature kind of dangerous, and many of them have DNA-damaging effects. The fragrances are a funny story because companies are allowed to claim the ingredients in their fragrances as a trade secret. So on almost every item at the drugstore, it seems like, you look at the ingredients list, and it'll have a number of crazy chemical names, and then it'll say fragrance, and it doesn't tell you what's in the fragrance. And there are actually a number of fairly commonly used fragrance ingredients that have very strong endocrine disrupting, and in some cases they've been shown to have carcinogenic effects. So that's something we're particularly worried about. There's also a class of chemicals called phthalates that appear to have very strong endocrine disrupting effects. Those are some, but not all of the things that we would worry about in terms of those products. And it quickly gets very overwhelming. I have a coworker who likes to say, you know, she has a PhD, and she likes to say, well, but you know, I shouldn't have to have a PhD to the drugstore or the grocery store, and yet.
Right. And the advocacy piece?
Yeah, so, you know, we talk about sometimes a three-legged stool that, you know, it has to have all three pieces to stand up. And one of those legs is education and personal action. And so that is, you know, really sharing this with others. A program like this absolutely helps that. And that's like tips that follow exactly from the science Janet just described, such as avoid synthetic fragrance in almost everything. That's one of my top five tips that I share. Just skip it. We don't know what's in that ingredient, you know, so we go past it. Share that with your friends, and let's make change by having that ripple effect. A second one, leg of the stool, is market-based change. And so the Breast Cancer Fund is founding member and host to the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics. You can look that up, Google that, and join us on Facebook through our mailing list and stuff like that. And we will send you different actions to take. A lot of them are quite fun to participate in and be part of a movement to ask the markets to change. That might be specific companies or companies that you know, market cosmetics or household cleaners or even retailers that sell those things. And we do that because the market can often turn much more quickly than laws. You know, we saw this with the case of bisphenol A in plastic water bottles. Moms, healthcare providers, and others started demanding change in that realm, and pretty quickly, alternatives were introduced in the market to BPA. Stainless steel, one of the best and most stable examples for a water bottle there. So market-based change. But those two on their own are going to leave some people out of the equation. And so policies have to change. And that what that does is raise the floor of safety for everybody so that we're not having poor people, people of color, people living in less urban areas, not having the same kinds of alternatives that others might have. So we have to have policy change as well.
Email that we received gets into the issue, perhaps, of pesticides. This is a person who has a cabin in the interior, and where often people have cabins or have trouble with flies and other bugs, and a friend of theirs was using an insect strip called Hot Shot. This person who sent me the email got some Hot Shot and noticed it was pretty doggone effective. But then she began to notice that it says on here should not be used in places where people inhabit for more than 2 hours or around foods or places where food is processed, and that the state of California had some warnings on the package. And then, unfortunately, one of her friends that used this for an unknown length of time did develop breast cancer, and she questioned is, was there a potential connection between the misuse of the product and the breast cancer in her friend?
So I would say it's always impossible to say what caused any one person's cancer, and especially without knowing the specifics of what was in that product. You know, I couldn't give you a yes or no answer, but there is fairly strong evidence that, as we talked about with DDT, many other pesticide ingredients have been linked to definitely tumors in animal studies and, in some cases, breast cancers in women.
And another thing there, you know, that's very tricky is it's often quite hard for us as consumers to make safer decisions. And when something like that happens, you know, we don't want to engage in some sense of blaming the victim, right? Someone gets breast cancer, we don't know what caused that, and it's very easy for us to ask questions why, but there is such a huge lack of disclosure when it comes to these things, you know, and such a huge data gap in terms of what we know about them that we really have to take into consideration here. And so if you look at any household use pesticides, they have to label the active ingredients, which are often quite a small proportion of the overall product, but they do not have to label the inert ingredients at all. So you have no idea as a consumer what you're really buying.
Well, there's another, this is Patty, there's another piece of that puzzle that we haven't actually talked about yet. There is what are you buying in the store, and sometimes you know and sometimes you don't know, and that's bad enough. But one of the things that we face here in Alaska is global transport of contaminants from temperate zones northward on air and water currents. And then when they reach the colder air up here, they precipitate out and deposit themselves on the land or in the water. And the animals eat them, the plants take them up. And women in the Arctic have been shown to have 9 times the concentrations of these chemicals, particularly a certain class of pesticides that the effects are so alarming and the concentrations are so alarming in northern women, particularly in their, not just in their breast tissue, but also in their breast milk. And it was so alarming to the global community that the Stockholm Convention was, which is a treaty, was formed just to regulate these chemicals. So there's a way in which we in the northern climates are taking a hit for what is going on in the lower 48. And there's nothing we can do about that short of participating in the Stockholm Convention.
Absolutely. And I think when we hear stories like that and we think about a global problem like that, it can feel, you know, very, very disempowering and discouraging and frightening. But what it exemplifies when you really bring it down to it is that we all have a responsibility as, you know, global citizens or whatever you want to call it, to change this, to pass a better law to regulate toxic substances, those that are going to concentrate in Arctic areas, those that are going to affect people in different occupations differently, those that are going to be more prominent in neighborhoods that are either in poverty or neighborhoods of color, that we have to change this law because we are creating a huge disparity in exposure, and we are all part of that story. So we can all be part of the problem, or we can all be part of the solution.
I think another, this is Janet, another important thing to note about the Stockholm Convention's chemicals and the chemicals that tend to accumulate in the Arctic is that in addition to showing up there, they stick around for a long time. So it's not enough to start regulating a chemical after we've been exposed and started to think it might be a problem, because even after you stop producing it, it'll stick around for a long time. And we've seen that with pesticides that have been banned. We've seen that with PCBs and perfluorinated chemicals. So we really need to, that's just another kind of reason for calling for real proactive action on these chemicals.
We've got about 5 minutes left. I have a couple of emails I'd like to try to get to if possible. One of them is very simple. It's a question. The question is, does taking birth control pills increase the risk of breast cancer?
Okay. So it does. It has a slight increase. Women that have a slightly increased risk of breast cancer for about 5 years after they stop taking birth control. Birth control pills also slightly reduce the risks of other cancers, and the increased effect pretty much goes away after a few years. And because those years of the relatively increased risk are years when a woman is relatively unlikely to develop breast cancer, it ends up being a fairly small effect in terms of the actual number of cases.
One more email, if we have time, if we can do this. Then I want to ask you all to help us understand what we might be doing to decrease our risks of exposures. But this is an email that says, I have three sisters, all living, who have had breast cancer. I also have two aunts who have died of breast cancer. We all grew up in a farm in Iowa, including the two aunts. We are now participating in an NIH sister study on breast cancer. We know we have none of the genes that have been associated with increased risk. What are your thoughts about environmental exposure that all of us may have had? Any comments on that question?
I think this is one that really exemplifies the challenges in this field. You know, there are genes that we don't yet know how to measure that may not on their own increase any given person or family's risk of breast cancer, but that may make people more vulnerable to specific exposures. In Iowa, definitely high rates of pesticide use, especially the pesticide atrazine, which has rather complex endocrine disrupting properties, you know, and many, many others. But we can't answer, as Janet has said, the situation of an individual person or family. But those interactions really come to mind when I hear a question like that.
All right, we have a couple of minutes left. Who wants to tell us some very specific thoughts and ideas that we all can do to maybe decrease the risk of breast cancer?
Well, so I think that we all... Oh, go ahead, Janet.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'll do one, then you do one. Let's we'll do speed round. Okay, avoid synthetic fragrance in almost everything.
Okay.
Yeah, reduce your exposure to fuels and solvents, I would say.
Pick cleaning products that have ingredient labels. They don't have to disclose that, so pick the ones that actually do, or make your own.
Try to avoid flame retardants in furniture and other products, and ask for flame retardant-free products, even if they're not currently available. They might be soon.
Don't microwave in plastic.
I would say try to avoid flexible vinyl products, including shower curtains, as much as possible because of the phthalates that help make them flexible.
When possible, go organic with your foods. Go fresh in that very short growing season you have up there, or frozen vegetables are probably better than canned vegetables.
They try to reduce...
Go ahead.
Oh, try to reduce or control dust levels within the home by vacuuming with a good vacuum with a HEPA filter, or just mopping with plain old water or a little bit of soap.
Use a water filter, and also I would say wash your hands, because when we wash our hands, we wash that household dust off, and that reduces our exposures as well.
All right. Well, this, as usual, for me, has been a very, very educational hour, and it's been very fast. I want to say thanks to both of you for taking the time to be with us, and good luck on your travels up here and with your travels around the state once you get here.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
All right, you guys have a great day. So my thanks to our guests today, Connie Engel of the Breast Cancer Fund, Janet Ackerman of Silent Spring Institute, and Patty Saunders, who joined us in the station today from the Alaska Community Action on Toxics. If you'd like to continue our conversation on environmental links to cancer, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You'll find that link on our website, www.alaskapublic.org, where you can also find the link to our archives. And please let us know your thoughts and suggestions at line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to be off next week, next Monday for Memorial Day, and the following Monday our guest will be Anchorage neurosurgeon Dr. Marius Maxwell, and we're going to be talking about newer approaches to surgery of the spine. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, June 2nd. Pat Yak is Chief Contact Officer at Alaska Public Media. Monica Goki is our web editor and also engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.